We are pleased to inform you that you have a place at Potterversity.
Welcome to Potterversity, a Potter Studies podcast. This is episode 24. Rock on. Thanks for joining us at Potterversity. Today, Emily Strand and I will talk with Paul Thomas about the world of wizard rock. I am Katie McDaniel, professor of history at Marietta College in Marietta, Ohio, and co-editor of Harry Potter for Nerds 2.
And I am Emily Strand, instructor of comparative religions and cultural competency at Mount Carmel College and author of several Harry Potter essays.
Our topic for today's episode is the expression of Harry Potter fandom through the musical genre, wizard rock, or rock with a W.
With a W, yeah.
Emily, you have been known to express your fandom through music, including the music for our podcast.
Yes.
So tell indeed. Us what inspired you and tell us how you went about doing that.
Oh, yes, I really enjoyed doing it. You know, I will admit flat out that when we were planning our podcast, the goal that was foremost in my mind was avoiding copyright infringement.
Yes.
And yet still, and you know that because we had long conversations about it.
Yeah. See episode 20.
See,
or no, it was 19. Episode 19.
Right, right. So that was a big inspiration for me. I liked to do that, you know, because the goal was to create a Potterific atmosphere, you know, with the music while not breaking copyright. Mm-hmm. So I loved that challenge. And back in the day, I probably, you know, I would say I got my start as a professional musician playing in cover bands. So we would cover other people's songs. And mm-hmm. and sometimes, you know, there's two ways to play cover songs. You either play it exactly like the original, or you completely reinvent it. I feel like, in my opinion, there's no in between. Like, you got to go one or the other way. So the challenge was to take a Potter theme or two or three and sort of reinvent them. And so I really enjoyed that challenge. And my band in Cincinnati, who we don't really play together anymore, but we're still friends, they helped out. Sean Ellsburn helped me out with some of the production and the percussion for sure. And then Ashley Shepard helped out with the bass and guitar, and Scott Hacker played just some wonderful guitar on our outro music. That's probably my favorite part of the outro music is Scott's cool Telecaster in that piece. So, and our listeners can maybe identify. I think our opening song is easy to identify as Hedwig's theme, but the closing is a little bit trickier to identify. So maybe our listeners can write in if they've identified that piece of music from Potter.
Yeah. And so that's your band is The Town, right?
Correct.
And Travis Prinzi did a little of the,
oh yeah, that's right. I forgot
the vocals on that too, which
yes.
is fun.
On the outro. Travis did. Cause he had helped with the music for our former iteration of the podcast,
yes.
Reading, Writing, Rolling, which I have to say, Emma Nicholson just did some fantastic lyrics.
Yeah, the lyrics were wonderful on that.
And then Travis and I collaborated on the music for that. And Travis took the lead and I just kind of supported him. And that was a fun time too. So look that up in our previous iteration, listeners, if you're interested.
And I sort of feel like, you know, if you are somebody who does music, you're a musician and you love Harry Potter, Maybe it just feels natural to have that be part of, you know, the way that you enjoy it.
Oh,
I'm not,
I think that's definitely true. I think that's definitely true. And I see that also in my 10-year-old son, who, as he gets interested in a particular franchise, if music is involved in that franchise, he wants to kind of express his interest in the franchise with, you know, so Star Wars themes or Harry Potter themes or, you know, other. We were even watching another movie the other day, totally unrelated, but he was really noticing the music and really liking the music. So I definitely think for musical beings, I think that's definitely part of it.
Yeah, well, today we are going to focus on rock with the W. So you can imagine the W every time I say that. Rock is a particular kind of musical expression in the Harry Potter fandom that became immensely popular and has remained an important part of the fan community. And maybe some of our listeners have themselves heard some of the bands that play Wizard Rock or gotten themselves a CD, heard a group at a festival, something like that. And our guest helping us to explore this phenomenon is Paul Thomas, a library specialist at the University of Kansas. Paul has a Master of Arts in Social Science from the University of Chicago and is getting his PhD from Emporia State University in Library and Information Management. Paul wrote the book, I Wanna Rock, the publisher's McFarland, 2019. And he also has his own rock band called The Eighth Horcrux.
Awesome name. Awesome name.
Welcome to the show, Paul.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to talk today.
I found your book really fascinating, and I think that listeners will too. How great to have a whole book devoted to what has really been a really important major pop culture phenomenon. And the fact that you have a band yourself, I think is also a kind of, it gives you some expertise in the field as well. So tell us, Paul, how did you get interested in the Harry Potter books, and specifically what made you get into Wizard Rock?
So, man, I have to, pull out my pensieve to do this, because it was, I was in third grade, so it would have been,
oh, wow.
Yeah, the fall of 2001. I don't exactly remember why I started reading the first one, but I do remember the commercial for the movie coming out. That's probably somewhat what nudged me in that direction.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh, that looks really cool. So I read the first book and the second book that winter. And after that, I was just like kind of devouring the books as they came out. I sort of fell off the Harry Potter train, maybe in like, not like in early high school, not fell off, I guess. Just, I was like, you know, it's a fun book kind of mentality. And then I really got back into it with Wizard Rock in 2009. It's always been a part of my childhood and kind of adolescence growing up. So I would never say there was a time where I didn't have Harry Potter involved somewhere. But yeah, I would trace it back to then, 2001. So that also, that was right. Was that right when the Goblet of Fire had come out? It was before Order of the Phoenix. I remember that.
Yeah.
And I remember when the seventh book came out, I was a teenager at the point, but my parents wouldn't let me go to the midnight premiere. But my dad went anyway and bought the book for me, which I was like, okay. And then the next day I spent, of like everyone else reading it, spent the entire day reading the book. But the problem was I was working at a county fair for my 4-H club, because I was doing 4-H at the time. And I walked around doing what I was supposed to do while reading the entire time. And it was one of those things where I think if it had normally happened like that, if it was just like another book or a random book that I was reading, people would have told me to stop. But when they saw it was the new Harry Potter book, they're like, okay, I get it.
That's awesome. Yeah. Oh, can't blame him for trying to read that Harry Potter book. It's the last one. Yeah, that's great. And I guess I just did a quick look up of my Goblet of Fire. I have all my books right here where I podcast. And Goblet of Fire was 2000. So 2001 is probably, you know, 2000, 2001. And then it was 2007 for the Deathly Hallows, which I remember because I have a child born in that year. Paul, we're in a different generation.
It's weird because I'm like, oh yeah, that was just a couple of years ago, and then I'm like, no, that was more than a couple of years ago.
Yes.
So 2009, it sounds like you sort of found Wizard Rock and that brought you back to the Harry Potter world, is that right?
Yeah, that's basically what I'd say. was a funny story because largely the reason that I started doing this is because I mean, I guess the word is fell in love, but it seems kind of funny to use that because I was in high school. But there was a girl
you could
I really
fall
liked.
In love in high school.
Yeah, I think we definitely did. My wife is named Trina, and we met started junior year in high school, and I liked her a lot, and I was trying to, you know, talk to her and find some way of starting a conversation. And as I kind of mentioned in the book, we started talking about Wizard Rock, and at first it was kind of like, haha, that's funny. And then the more and more we thought about it, the more and more we were like, oh, you know what, we should write our own music. That'd be fun. I think another thing that sort of nudged us in that direction was that we were starting to really get into talking about the books and talking about about music and stuff. And a lot of my friends at the time were kind of being kind of aloof about it. Like they didn't think it was interesting.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. And so we were like, well, we're going to make this. And then everyone was like, oh, you're going to make an album? Okay. And we were like, yes, we are going to do it. We are going to get them, you know, professionally printed out and everything. And
nice.
We will sell them.
Yeah.
And we
mock
did.
Mock us, if you will.
Exactly.
But we will be selling these.
Exactly.
I love
and
it.
And thinking back to that, our first album, I cringe because some of the songs are just really kind of dumb and bad, but it was still a lot of fun. And I remember putting the record together, like, I want to say late at night on Sundays, but it was probably like 8 o'clock on Sundays or something, because that was when we had free time. She'd come over to my house and we'd record in the basement. And I just remember having our little rig set up there, which was just this super old computer, and we were running Audacity. That was it.
Oh yeah.
And we were recording stuff with an amp that was terrible on a bright pink guitar that I had borrowed from a friend. So it was just like a very vivid memory. And we were writing lyrics, and we would send them back and forth on Facebook Messenger and like make tweaks and improvements and stuff like that. So that was that's a good time in my memories, even if at the time there was some kind of like drama that was frustrating. But I think it worked out because we got married in 2017. So
I guess so.
It worked. So the trick to get a significant other is start a band with them and then get married several years later.
Right. I love everything about this story, Paul. Everything about this story I just love, from the pink guitar to the happy ending.
Here's another curveball. My wife and I actually went to the same kindergarten together. And then she moved away.
Oh.
And then she came back. So when people ask us, oh, when did you meet? We're always like, the first time or the second time? Because there's a story here. So, but anyway.
I love it. And Wizard Rock helped you impress her. And then like has you've kept going with your band and everything. That's wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah. It's been well over 10 years now. Because that was in 2009. So 13. Is that right?
Yeah.
Is that how math works? Something like that.
That's amazing. Cause I mean, you know, I was like at that same age, you know, just starting to get into playing in bands and stuff. And those memories are so good. Like you're talking about the ancient equipment that you were using and the very rudimentary stuff, but to have those memories with your current spouse, you know, is just really amazing to be able to keep those memories alive. Because a lot of the people I made music with back then are kind of long gone from my life, but it's fun to think about that. So turning a little bit more to your study of Wizard Rock, tell us what you found. What are the roots of rock, and how did this genre develop over the last 20 years?
So that's it's kind of a complex topic. There is sort of a canonical origin story, if you will, of Wizard Rock, but it kind of started at different points in different points in time. The origin story is usually trace it back to the song "Ode to Harry" by the band Switchblade Kitten, which came out at the end of 2000.
That name was phenomenal. Switchblade.
It is. Mm-hmm. It's a great name, and the band is like pop punk.
I looked up the song, of course, reading your book. I had to read it with right by my computer so I could look up and listen to all the songs.
It's the best way to read.
And that was kind of like the first one that dropped, and it's a really great song. I'm a big like Paramore fan, so there's kind of overlap there in terms maybe. Yeah, like that pop punk energy. I like that.
Yeah, and they do a lot of like folk type music too. Paramore does, like, because they did a lot of songs for the Twilight a soundtrack. Am
Oh,
I
that's right. Yeah, you're right.
right about that? Yeah, because I guess the lead singer was like really inspired by Twilight and wrote a bunch of songs,
Yeah,
kind of vaguely
the
about Twilight.
Decode, the single Decode was,
Yeah,
yeah.
great song.
Yeah, it is a good song. Well, Wizard Rock kind of started there. There is a little fun tangent that Bruce Springsteen recorded a song for the first movie that never actually got released. So people
Whoa.
are like, oh, maybe the second Wizard Rock song is Bruce Springs. It was a Bruce Springsteen production. But then the
Yeah, I
real.
listened to that one too, but I have to say, I like the Switchblade Kitten song
I do as
better.
well. I do as well. It's a. It, I don't. It's been a while since I heard the Bruce Springsteen one, and it felt a little too sentimental, maybe, for the genre
Yeah.
and how it became
Right.
melodramatic, maybe.
Taking itself too seriously.
And then in 2002, that's when the movement really kind of started with Harry and the Potters.
Right.
The band founded by Paul and Joe DeGeorge from Massachusetts. Fun fact, when I was really into like first getting into Wizard Rock, Paul moved to Lawrence, Kansas, which is where I was going to university.
Oh,
And so
cool.
one day I was at the record store and I had a Harry and the Potters t-shirt on and I saw him and he saw the shirt and came over. And so every once in a while we bump into each other. So it's
That's
very
awesome.
strange that
That is
of
very cool. I'd be wearing my Harry and the Potter shirt everywhere I went after
Oh
that.
yeah.
I actually do own a Harry and the Potter shirt, and it is one of my all-time favorite t-shirts. In fact, it's like really worn out, but I'm having trouble letting it go
I
because it's
have
such a
one.
great. It's the
Yeah.
Save Ginny shirt.
Oh wow, is that like one of the original or is that a reprint or whatever? I know those are the
I know I bought it in 2015 at the Chestnut Hill Harry Potter conference and festival because they played in the basement of Chestnut Hill College on the night of the first, and it was just a fabulous concert. It was great. And I'd actually already seen them in Columbus. I live in Columbus, Ohio, and I'd seen them at Ace of Cups in Columbus, Ohio. And so, yeah, I'm a big fan of Harry and the Potters.
I think they were technically my first concert.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
I remember that actually, and I was in high school the first time I went out and started doing music and stuff. And I remember my mom drove me and Trina up to see Harry and the Potters at the Lawrence Public Library in probably 2010, maybe. And so I always like to tell people, yeah, my first concert was a Wizard Rock performance at a library,
I
and
love that.
it was a ton of fun.
It's a totally new way of sticking it to the man.
Exactly. And yeah, so the DeGeorge brothers really kind of created the modern face of the Wizard Rock movement by starting Harry and the Potters, which sort of started as a joke. They needed to kill some time at a concert that they were hosting in their backyard, so they threw some songs together about Harry Potter and, made the audience laugh and then moved on. But then when when Order of the Phoenix, the book came out, they were like, you know what? There might be a market for something like this. So they recorded their first album and then just started doing shows at Borders and then started doing shows at libraries. And then one thing led to another. And pretty soon they were touring around the country, which is sort of unbelievable to think about. And then they were, when younger folks saw them or heard them, they were inspired. And then so Wizard Rock groups started to pop up kind of in different parts of the world, and it just sort of spiraled from there. It's still very much an underground thing, but there was a time where it was like fairly popular for being unpopular, if that's a
Yeah,
term for that,
yeah,
especially
yeah.
on MySpace.
It had its niche.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. And you said that they sort of established almost a little formula that other people would follow. So it was like you had Harry and the Potters, but then you had Draco and the Malfoys, and there were other bands that did basically that was the way a lot of the names were even modeled.
I know that there was a lot of like scrambling to get names sort of locked down so that like, oh, this is our character.
Right.
You can't take ours. That naming convention started to change though after the first big wave of bands, and then we started to get some really very original names into the mix.
Yeah, I like that's part of why I like your band's name is because it's just breaks the mold a little bit, little different. So tell us, so as the genre formed, what became its most distinctive features?
That's a great question. And it's interesting because Wizard Rock as a genre is defined not really by its music. Like the music is all over the place. It's defined at least in my mind, it's defined as what the lyrical content is and how the lyrical content is sort of being presented. So you have someone like Harry and the Potters, who are kind of like indie rock sounding. You have someone like the band Switch and Flick that do more like rap stuff. And then you have the Eighth Horcrux that does both all over the place. You know, we do all sorts of genres because we're a parody band. And we're, all of us are united in the sense that our lyrics are sort of loving, often funny trip. Well, if I may say so, funny tributes to the Harry Potter universe. So that's a big unifier. And it's weird because I can't think of many other genres out there that are like that. Filk is probably the one that comes closest, since that is sort of a fun stew of kind of nerdy topics, very similar to Wizard Rock, just maybe a little more broader in its boundaries.
Mm-hmm. So Paul, can you define filk for listeners? Because I mean, I know it because I read your book, but I think there are maybe a lot of listeners who don't know what filk means. F-I-L-K.
Filk is both a type of music as well as sort of a subculture to describe music that is largely about science fiction books, movies, series, or fantasy novels. It's very popular in convention circles. Basically, mm-hmm. when people had some time to kill after a convention, they would group up together and play songs, kind of folky sort of songs. And the name filk is from a misspelling of the word folk, and it just sort of stuck. And so it's very broad in its sound. Like I know that there are parodies that filkers will do, write parody songs, and then they'll write their original sort of like folk tunes. But it's very sort of, yeah, it's focused on kind of like a pop culture lens looking at music, or maybe the other way around, music mm-hmm. looking through a pop culture lens. It's very diverse. And I don't want to offend any filkers if I gave a wrong definition, because I know that it's a very, very like complex subculture. And there's a lot of layers to it and a lot of layers of meaning too. So if I glossed anything a little superficially, just know I apologize. I have the utmost respect for the community.
Well, we will take the heat if you did, Paul. I don't think you did, but we'll take the heat. You can email us, listeners, if you think that Paul got it wrong and set us all straight.
Yeah, but I love how you know, this is, the things that I love, I like to take them apart and see how they mm-hmm. work. And you do that with rock. And you identify, like you said, that it has these punk roots. It kind of comes out of, you know, this convention folk music, filk. And then it's also tied into fan fiction, right? Where you have people mm-hmm. who are, like you say, what is binding it together is this, the love for Harry Potter and the characters and the, you know, the ways that even like the vocabulary of the stories is the center point of what unites it as a genre.
Yeah. And it can be really strange for people who don't know Harry Potter when they cue up a Wizard Rock song. They're like, what are they talking about? What are these words? Who are these people? And I know my mom hasn't read the Harry Potter books, and she's seen a couple of the movies. So when we were showing her our music, she was like, it sounds good. I don't know what any of it means. So I can't tell you if it's funny, but it sounds good.
I love I think it's in your introduction about how you talk about that there's a community that's formed around the Wizard Rock because the members of it have sort of a matched level of enthusiasm for Harry Potter. And that really rang true to me because I participate in Star Wars costuming groups.
Oh, okay.
And so like I'm a member of the Rebel Legion, and I think that that's like when I decided to go and join those, I think that's what I was looking for is for other Star Wars fans, especially locally, who could sort of match my level of enthusiasm for the franchise. And that's exactly what these people are doing. It's like Katie, we often say, you know, there's certain circles where you can't over nerd. You're not in danger of that. You're, you know, this is okay. It's okay to express the level of enthusiasm that you have. No one's going to judge you. In fact, this is encouraged. And I love that aspect of Wizard Rock too.
Definitely. And there's that, in my opinion, one of the worst feelings out there is when you are like, hey friends, look at this thing that I really like, or this thing I made. I want to show it to you. And they just go, eh, and then turn around and do something else, you
Yes.
know? And you're like, I have no one
But
to express my interest to.
yeah, you don't get
Exactly.
it. You don't get
Yeah.
it, man.
So when you can do that with Wizard Rock and being like, look at this song that I wrote, this goofy, that maybe four people will laugh at, but that's four people that are laughing at it, you know?
Yeah. Who
That
get
get it.
it?
Yeah.
Unlike you, I mean, God bless your mom, but unlike your mom,
Exactly.
they get it,
Yeah,
right.
one of those Harry and the Potter songs. Sometimes I've played some of their music for my Harry Potter class because I want them to be interested in the fandom and those kinds of expressions as well, which, like you are doing here, it's also very much grounds for analysis, right? So, but one of their songs was about the wizard money. I
Oh, yeah,
can't remember the name of
the
this.
economics of the wizarding world don't make sense.
Right.
Yeah, because they don't.
Yeah. It's so funny to play that for the students, and they're like, what am I listening to?
It's a song, but it could easily be a very well-argued academic article.
A quick tangent on that. Paul DeGeorge was selling this cauldron bottom report at his shop in Lawrence. He
Oh my.
helps run a like a little art boutique shop. And it's written in character as Percy Weasley, like talking about the thickness of specific cauldron bottoms, and it has like
Yeah.
graphs and stuff.
Yeah.
And I just was in love with that idea, because when he was telling me about it, he was like, I tried to make it as boring as possible, like as dull and dry as you could make magic cauldrons. And I loved that idea. And so I went home and I wrote up like a scientific journal article as if I was Newt Scamander, and I wrote it about the Niffler, and I gave it a Latin name. I had a Latin
Wow.
species description, and I had all this fun stuff, I managed to sell a few copies at his store, and just kind of the sort of, he calls it fan nonfiction. I like that. I want to see more of
Oh,
that.
wow. Yeah. Oh, that is awesome. Yeah, you
That's
know,
genius.
right, I'm thinking of David Martin. Our friend David Martin has written a spoof on the 12 fail-safe ways to charm witches
Oh.
from the opposite gender point of view. And I keep telling him he needs to post that somewhere. It's got to be, because it's like very funny and, you know, as only David Martin can do. But yeah, fan
Absolutely.
nonfiction. I love that concept.
I think it's really hilarious, and it's one of those things that if you're like a hardcore fan, you know.
Yeah.
Like the little one I made had my mom drew. My mom, she gets points for this. She drew me a beautiful like inked portrait or an inked picture of the Niffler. So I have that on the cover,
Oh,
and just
cool.
in large
Wonderful.
text, it just says, you know, species description of Magisaculus raptor, parenthetical, the Brit common British Niffler, Newt Scamander, Journal of Magizoology or whatever. And so it looks both very official, boring, but also like if you're in the know, you know what's going on.
Paul, I want a copy of this. I feel I need it. And you know what? With how much attention Nifflers are getting with the Fantastic Beasts series, I think you've got a market for your Niffler scientific
Right.
article.
Well,
Etsy digital download.
I
There you
did
go.
create a LaTeX version of the article that I've been sharing with people as like a, see, you can make learning about biology or something fun for your students. So I'm more than happy to forward that to you all
Oh,
if you
that's
want a copy.
wonderful. That's so cool. Yeah, that's a good idea too.
Well, Paul, in your book, I Want to Rock, you talk about not just the performances, but also what you call the performativity of the musical groups. What does that mean, performativity? And how does that affect the experience of the music for both the performers and the audience?
Performativity, in the way that I'm using it, is a fairly technical term. I think nowadays we usually associate that word with just like I always hear it with like performative activism or something like that, which sort of means like you're doing something but not actually really doing anything. And in the world of
Right.
social science, performativity is kind of the opposite. It has its roots in the linguist J.L. Austin, who was discussing how it's interesting how with language, humans have the tendency to have language that just declarative statements like this is a book, you know, that is those are car that's carpet, you know, that sort of thing. But we also have language that, as soon as it's said, changes reality. And the example he always gives, or he liked to talk about, was the like the wedding ceremony, when you say, you know, I now pronounce you husband and wife. His example, of course, was pretty heteronormative, but that's the example he gave. Right. Because at that moment, mm-hmm. when the hoop minister or the officiant or the judge or whatever says that, that's when the marriage happens. And that's why, of course, you know, in movies, people run in and be like, I object, because they stopped the saying from happening. Right. It's almost like magic. And then...
yeah, it's like spell casting in a way. Yeah, you express the words to bring it into being.
Exactly.
Right.
And it's
performative utterance, right? Isn't that what we call it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then in the late 80s, early 90s, Judith Butler took that idea and sort of ran with it. But she took it in the sphere of gender and gender studies. And her idea was basically that not only are there performative utterances, but there are performative actions effectively, and gender is one of them. And her argument is basically that there's no like set in stone book somewhere that says this is what male gender roles, female gender roles. They're things that humans observe and learn and then sort of cite. It's a form of citation. Oh, you know, they do this, I got to do that too to be part of this group. And the other aspect of it is that it's kind of unconscious. It's something that you do without thinking about it. So it's not a case of waking up in the morning and saying like, I'm going to be X gender. It's a case of waking up in the morning and having that already sort of in your brain that you are whichever gender either you've been told you are or that you associate with. And then you perform the traits associated with that gender, which then constitutes reality and makes you situated in that sort of gendered discourse. And I read a really good article. This is a very long-winded explanation, but I read a very good article about gender performativity and its relation to cosplay by Nicole Lamarix, I believe. And she argued basically that cosplay is very similar. You put on a costume so that when people see you, they sort of make a connection between you and the character. So when I go and cosplay as Sonic the Hedgehog, that's the first thing I saw. If I cosplay as Sonic the Hedgehog, I'm making some sort of statement about me that I want people to sort of associate the two. And it could be the opposite. Like I could cosplay as a bad guy and then there's sort of an anti-association, like, oh, I know Paul, he's a nice guy. He's not like Darth Vader. So it sort of reaffirms the difference, which still constructs your personality and how people perceive you. So I just sort of took that and resituated it in Wizard Rock, because I think there is very much an element of that, especially with the bands that do the kind of role-playing like Harry and the Potters. They are seen by a lot of fans as Harry Potter, or at least Harry Potter-ish, because of what their band has done, how they perform on stage and how they...
they wear the glasses and...
Exactly, yeah. So it's all citing the Harry Potter-ness and applying it to them. And then even when they're not performing, people still have that association in their mind. Like, oh yeah, you're the Harry and the Potters guy. You know, you're that Harry Potter person who sings music about Harry Potter. And the Harry Potter is just sort of, you know, all over this conversation. And then that sort of colors how people see him. And so I think that's a very important element of Wizard Rock, because this isn't a case where it's people just necessarily singing songs about a book. It's a case often where they're singing songs about a book and sort of putting forth an ideology and a shared system of beliefs and values, and they're wanting the audience members to either recognize that or sort of join in and mm-hmm. become a part of that. So it's very performative in the sense that it can very literally change reality for these people and sort of shift them into alternate beings for a moment that code how we see them.
You described in the book that you had seen Draco in the Malfoys and that you had talked to the Draco before
Brian Ross,
the Draco. And just found him to be a kind of nice guy, funny guy, a little self-deprecating even maybe.
Yeah, he was very quiet. And I mean, we were at a concert and I was like, oh, I really like your music. And he was like, oh, thanks. You know, it's nice to meet you. Just very, yeah, very professional, quiet, nice. And then I also talked to Brad, the other Draco, talked to him through Facebook, asked him some questions, and he was also really forthcoming and really nice and answered my questions. Both of them lovely people. So it's just funny to see them then get up on stage.
Yeah. And you said when they perform, like you get some Draco snark.
Yeah. You know? And you're like, wow, he's not like that in real life because he's a nice person in real life. That man's, you know, good person, that kind of thing. So it sort of works both in reverse. Of course, you could go down the rabbit hole and say that means you could argue that literally everything humans do is performative. And that's a discussion for another day.
Yeah, but right.
I definitely think Wizard Rock is a good case of performativity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's almost like a way of kind of claiming an identity. And I think for some people, it isn't the identity that they usually perform, you know, but it's sometimes our identities can be burdensome, you know, and so we kind of need a break from that and we need to do something really different and draw a little bit of something about that, you know, whether even, I mean, I know several Darth Vaders and they, you know, none of them are autocratic, you know, megalomaniacal, you know, mass murderers. I know. Well, that's true. But they all have there's a real sense of like personal power that sort of surrounds them. Like when they walk into a room, they're big personalities, you know. And it's really cool to see how they've kind of tapped into that aspect of the character, and they, you know, bring it into who they are and their identity.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's just identity formation, like you said, way of establishing an identity is exactly sort of the root of it. And that's a good way of describing it.
Well, tell us about your band. Tell us about the Eighth Horcrux. What are some of your, I know you mentioned Weird Al, which again, I completely support. But tell us about your musical influences and why do you connect with this aspect of Harry Potter fandom?
That's a great question because there are so many different inspirations to think about. Since we are a parody band, as you said, Weird Al is sort of the number one inspiration. And as an aside, another wonderful human being who we've got to see several times live in concert. And every time, it just sort of reaffirms my desire to write goofy music. But in addition to him, I would say, I think back in the day, I used to often say like, oh, you know, Harry and the Potters and They Might Be Giants. I really do like They Might Be Giants, but yes. I don't know if they have influenced us too much because we've never really gotten to parody any one of their songs, but I really like them. I like their music regardless.
I can hear the way that you, your voice, the vocal quality has a little They Might Be Giants.
Oh, thank you. I think that's a compliment, right?
It is. Yes, it is. Absolutely. I can tell. As soon as you said that, I was like, oh, yeah, I could definitely hear that.
One song I have been trying to write this for years now, instead of Birdhouse in Your Soul, something about Horcrux soul.
Ooh.
Horcrux in your soul. Horcrux from your soul. I don't know. Something like that.
Do it.
Make a Horcrux from
your soul.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That's all I got, though. But.
Flood is like one of my kids' favorite albums too. We listen to that a lot in the car.
That was one of my favorites growing up too. And it's a good car album because it's just so silly in like a serious way. I would say that actually, now that I think about that, the They Might Be Giants definitely informed our kind of playfulness. Like we want to be playful. Like we want to make music, but we also want to do it in a way that people can enjoy and have fun with.
Yeah.
Me and my wife are both big Weezer fans, so we always have like two or three Weezer parodies on every album, it seems like. That's another band I'd say that's kind of influenced the sort of music we want to listen to and make, sort of the heavy guitars and poppy vocals and stuff like that. A lot of the music that my wife and I have been listening to in the last few years has shifted radically from what we were listening to when we started the band. So that's been kind of an interesting direction to monitor. But usually
so you're evolving. Your sound is, you know, maybe evolving as your interests change.
Yeah, I moved largely from like not real hard rock, like alternative rock from the 90s and stuff. Still love that. Don't get me wrong. But I've branched out into a little more, some more pop. The problem that we both have is that the music we like this is going to sound like a boast, but it's not meant to be. It's increasingly underground, so we can't write parodies as readily because then people won't know what it is.
Right.
So I guess we're just too hip now. my wife came shuffling over here and wrote on a piece of paper, also Green Day. So she wanted me to, I forgot, Green Day was also a big influence. So that 90s alt rock sound.
Thank you, Trina.
Hi, Trina. Thanks.
She says hi.
That's awesome. So on the flip side of that question, what are the aspects of Harry Potter that you are particularly drawn to in terms of making the parodies? Like, are there particular characters or scenes or books or plot lines that you gravitate toward?
Oh, that's another good question. How Trina and I approach writing songs is kind of different. I am very much a fan of more of a Filk approach where I'm like, okay, I'm going to take this song and I'm going to rewrite it to be about this specific event or this book or something like that. And Trina likes to sort of do take a song and then just sort of pack it with funny references and change lines so that it sounds, you know, there's Harry Potter words, not necessarily just like pop culture references, but the joke comes from the fact that the line originally said this and we've changed it to something that is now Harry Potter, but it's still very close mm-hmm. to the original. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But it's more of like a medley kind of ideas and concepts. Right. So that's how we both approach songwriting. Speaking from my perspective, I really love the idea of taking an entire book and just condensing it down into a goofy little song or an entire plot or concept that was, you know, spread out over hundreds of pages and boiling it down to just a few minutes. The song that springs to my mind that I am very proud of, but not a lot of people seem to care too much about it, was I wrote a parody of Sister Christian by Night Ranger, you know, that ridiculous 80s song. And it was about, what was the chorus? Oh, it was about like sneaking out into the Forbidden Forest. And so the humor there came not only from telling that entire story of how they got detention, and the hook was, instead of motoring, it was McGonagall caught us in the night. The joke came from changing it, you know, the lyric to a Harry Potter thing, but also capturing that entire story, little section of the book in just a couple choruses and verses. I think that's really funny. I love comedy or filk music that does that with other pop culture franchises. So I brought that to the table with our band. And then, like I said, my wife loves to just sort of pepper things in so that it's a kind of a funny bowl of references, if you will.
She Potterfies it.
Exactly. Yeah. Potterfies it. And we used to have a joke where it was like, basically, like, is this a like something the standard internet would do? Like, if it was just like a really obvious word switch. Standard internet sounds mean, but you know, like a parody that someone posted on
like a TikTok or something.
Yeah, exactly like that. It's like, is that what would, is the quality good enough that it's more than that, or is it just that? I think Weird Al has a similar thing where he's like, if he comes up with an idea, he knows that there's going to be a billion other parodies of the song that he is working on, so he needs to make sure it's really good. So we would always be like, okay, maybe we need to work on that one a little more. Change this word here, change that word there, and keep it in the sort of on the back burner until it would come together and we felt that it was strong enough to be its own song.
So what were the challenges as you're talking? I can tell that, you know, you take a craftsperson's pride, an artist's pride in what you're putting together here, you know, even as it's, you know, fun and funny at the same time. But there's, you know, you're actually really putting a lot of work into it. When you were writing the book about Wizard Rock, you had both a critical analytical lens where you're trying to, you know, analyze this as a particular phenomenon, but also you are an insider. And so what were the challenges, but also benefits of, you know, your, you know, those two perspectives on the Wizard Rock arena?
So I come from a social scientific background, and I was really smitten with the writings of Clifford Geertz, who was an anthropologist who came up with the idea of like thick description.
Yeah.
And he often discussed the difference between sort of insider culture and outsider culture, or emic and etic culture, or viewpoints, excuse me, emic and etic viewpoints. where emic is insider information and edic or edic is outside. Most anthropologists that are studying a culture are from the outside looking in, and writing about something that I'm a member of already is an interesting challenge because I get to do that as an anthropologist, try to look out from the outside looking in, but I also have that insider information already. I don't necessarily need to go out and interview a bunch of people, although mm-hmm. that of course helps. But I have direct access to at least a part of what the je ne sais quoi of the whatever community it is. And so the challenge there is translating what I already know into, you know, text or ideas, because you don't know what you don't know, and you don't often recognize that what you know isn't interesting. Like maybe something that you're doing is like very weird, but to you it's normal. The struggle or the challenge there is to then try to think it like an outsider and be like, if my mom mm-hmm. was like watching us perform, what would she be like? That was strange, because that's the sort of little bits and pieces mm-hmm. that can help you construct a picture of the subculture. And that was tricky to do. I hope that I did my best, because there was a lot of soul searching and a lot of just me kind of like sitting there thinking like, what was it that we did? Oh yeah, we did this little thing. And that's kind of strange now that I think about it, or that's different. Basically anything that was sort of different or outside the norm, I wanted to touch on because it probably had some sort of meaning.
Yeah. And I want to say that I think your book does do a good job with that. And one of the mm-hmm. things that I liked was that it's very scholarly. You have, you know, the methods, and you know, the ways of looking at it, but you also have the personal stories about, you know, making your own band, and also, you know, like the Draco and the Malfoy story, right? That I think that give, like you say, that give you that, that other connection. And so I'm interested to know if, as you were doing that, as you were writing the book, if you did get some kind of personal insights that you wouldn't have had otherwise.
I guess it depends on what by personal do you mean, just like surprises and stuff like that?
Yeah, about what, like about, oh, I guess I like it, I do like it because of this, or I hadn't realized that this thing that I was doing is actually, you know, a part of something larger or what have you.
I never really stopped to think about how, I think the community aspect, I knew it was a community, but I never realized how much that the Wizard Rock was like really unified by that. It's, it mm-hmm. wasn't just like fans online all doing this, it's Wizard Rock fans. And the community aspect is so important and so powerful and so meaningful. And actually, probably the biggest surprise was that my wife and I are in the middle of Kansas, so we didn't have a lot of chances to go like to big cities and play shows and stuff. In fact, we played shows locally just at like libraries and stuff. So we first did our our first big show with other bands in 2016. The show was a fiasco for reasons that I won't go into, but it was the bands there were great and nice and friendly. It was Tongues and the R's, Draco and the Malfoys, Swish and Flick, and I think there were a couple others. And it was the first time that we'd ever sort of performed with these people or just met them, you know? And that's when a lot of it started to click. I was like, oh, this is that energy that people often talk about, that they feel when they're at Wizard Rock concerts or Wizard Rock events. You know, there's a connectedness, like we're all writing goofy songs about Harry Potter. And that's different, you know, that's not I use it in a normative sense, like normal thing to do, you know, most people, the vast majority of humans that have ever existed have not done that. So we are definitely in a,
this is true, safe to say,
while it needs some statistical analyses to verify that, but I think I feel pretty good about that. But yeah, that just that, oh wow, this is really connected. A lot of it was knowing that there were interesting elements of the community, that just sort of expressing that to others, like it's more than what you think it is.
Right. Yeah. And I definitely think that that comes through, so that you have the, you know, I think you have the analytic, the rational, like you said, like the statistics and all of that. And then you also, you get the things that are more affective, that are the emotional part of it, and that community aspect that you talked about. And the fact that you knew that there were those aspects going in is related to you being an insider in the community. You knew there was something there to look for.
Maybe the demographics are one area that I was kind of surprised. The data that I collected was kind of rough. You know, I mean, it was just a survey of, I can't remember, 300 people, I think maybe 150. Can't remember right off the top of my head, but I was just curious to see who all would answer. And the thing that I found interesting was that the nationality of Wizard Rock bands that responded was roughly similar to the breakdown of the bands that had been listed on the Wiz Rocklopedia in 2017 or 2012, excuse me, roughly the same percentages. And after the US, the UK and Australia and Canada, you know, English speaking nations, old Sweden there is just like a powerhouse of Wizard Rock for some reason. And that was a little mystery trying to figure that one out. And I reached
ABBA?
Out to...
Is it ABBA?
It could be. I mean, the Swedes know how to write a song. I will say that. Reaching out to some people from Sweden, I was kind of like, you know, do you have any ideas? They mentioned that it was basically the fact that there wasn't a lot of a community in Sweden. So the people that were there had to be like really tight-knit and united in their fondness for the series. And because of that, it was just like a stronger network. You know, the lack of a network kind of created a stronger network. And I think that's an interesting idea. I still, you know, it's why Sweden? I have no clue. It was, yes, Anna from the Swedish Short Snouts, who I talked to.
Oh, nice. I like the name.
It's a good, they're a great band. They just do wizard or dragon rock.
So Paul, how, and this is kind of like a two-part question. Like if somebody's listening to this and is like, I don't know anything about this world. How do I get involved in it? How do I get to know this? How do I become part of this community? So how would a fan kind of connect with this world? What are the best venues for that? And then also like, what about a musician who's sitting there thinking, I want to do this. I want to write these songs. What advice would you give to either of these people?
So in terms of connecting with the fandom, probably either Twitter, like just looking for Wizard Rock or Rock, WROCK, is a good way to find people. But also there's a really fairly active group on Facebook called the Wizard Rock Revival. And that's pretty much all of the major Wizard Rock people that are still making music or that did in the past and are just kind of like checking in. And you can talk to them and post new songs and stuff like that. That's sort of how I got into contact with a lot of the folks for the book. I just posted there and said, hey, you know, can I talk to you all? And most of them were like, yeah, absolutely. It's different because back in the day when we started, the best way to do it was to put your music on MySpace. But of course, those days are long in the past. So if you're trying to get music out there, maybe Bandcamp, is good because it has free hosting and but they pay you, you know, if you make sales. So that's a good option. In terms of musician, getting involved is probably first off, the number one ingredient, I think, that's kind of sprinkled throughout the book, but I don't know if I mentioned it in the last chapter. It's just being excited about Harry Potter. That energy that you bring to it is going to show in the recording or the performance. And so just embrace that. First rule there, just embrace your love of Harry Potter or whatever, you know, maybe you're doing a different book series, embrace that love. And then second thing is ask, if you want shows, ask venues that might not normally have kind of concerts, that especially if they're like more book oriented. So we, Trina and I, you have performed almost entirely in libraries and libraries love it. They absolutely love it. Especially during like the summer reading programs. So that's an option. In terms of getting music out there, again, I mentioned a Bandcamp is a good place to put your music, but just sharing it on Twitter links, you know, YouTube links or whatever. It'll, if you tag enough, you know, hashtags with Wizard Rock and stuff like that, it'll probably be found because there is a pretty dedicated small but dedicated group of people that sort of scour Twitter looking for new Wizard Rock or new comments and stuff. So you could probably get picked up there. I talk a lot about in the book sort of the technical details of how to become a band, like how to record, like what's the best way to approach recording, what's the best way to approach touring and stuff like that. I think one nice thing about Wizard Rock is that you can make a decent amount of money, nothing massive, but a decent number, with pretty minimal equipment and, in our case, talent, maybe. We
But a
would
lot of
also,
enthusiasm.
yeah, lots of
Yeah.
enthusiasm, lots of enthusiasm.
Yeah.
But like we made albums and we would play at libraries, and that made us, some gas money and enough to buy Taco Bell or whatever we were eating when we were teenagers. Yeah, so that's nice because it's sort of like it's a good genre to work in if you're on a budget, because people don't like, I've heard some Wizard Rock songs that sonically are not very good, but the lyrics are funny or the people are very sweet, and they're like, they're sharing it, with people trying to hoping that they don't just unnecessarily criticize them. And so yeah, it's a nice community to bring stuff into and to show like I made this thing. There's a reciprocity there. The Wizard Rock fandom, in my experience, is very opening and kind and nice. But you don't want to go in there just like guns a blazing and be a jerk and be like, "I got the best album. That's that other music's trash," or something like that. I don't think people would do that. But sometimes with music, it can get like a contest to like who's better.
Yeah,
And I've never
definitely.
really felt that with Wizard Rock.
Yeah, right. Are there, I'm just curious, are there any labels that are picking up these bands, or is everybody pretty much independent?
I guess it depends on how you define labels, because my wife and I released our albums under the quote unquote independent label Fueled by Pumpkin Juice, which is the name as a pun on Fueled by Ramen, which is the record label that Paramore is signed to.
Nice.
But other than that goofy little joke, not really. It's largely independent. I'm sure that there are songs about Harry Potter that have come out on major labels or even like major indie labels. I'm blanking off the top of my head of any major ones that I can think of. But most of it, yeah, is just like self-produced music that is being released online.
So, Paul, you talk about in the book that there's a kind of trajectory where, rock gets started after Harry and the Potters, and then it becomes really popular, but it's had a decline in more recent years. What do you think's, heading up next for Wizard Rock? Is it, are there going to be more surges, or, what do you think's on the horizon?
That's a great question. And it's one that I thought a lot about because when I wrote the book, it was in 2017, was when I kind of finalized it before edits and all that stuff. I was optimistic that the political environment, as well as like the fact that there were movies coming out, that there was going to be a surge in Wizard Rock. And to be fair, there has been an uptick, a noticeable uptick in specific bands releasing music and kind of consistently doing that. The big problem that happened was when J.K. Rowling started to go like really hardcore with a lot of the trans tweet stuff, that controversy, because most of the people that I know personally, or at least I'm decently close with, who are trans or non-binary, came from the Wizard Rock community, interestingly
Yeah,
enough. And
right.
so there was a big sort of hesitancy with many people, my wife and I included, to like, do we continue doing this? Because like, we don't want to su necessarily support opinions and ideas that we disagree with, because we did. But then I noticed that there were bands that were like, we're going to keep doing this. We're going to keep performing this music because the messages that we believe are inherent in the book series haven't changed just because the author necessarily has. Or has voiced an opinion that's, different, or so it's like it doesn't make sense to throw away something that has touched so many people and is, in my opinion, good, fun literature, just because the person who created it has done stuff that's not in line with the book series ideals. And the idea there was to just take the book and sort of run with it and own the messages that the fandom agreed with. And I've noticed that there's been an uptick in like LGBTQ and queer Wizard Rock songs,
Oh, good.
discussing like gender identity and stuff like that, which is really, really
Yeah.
awesome. And I think that's a very healthy direction
Yeah,
that
that's
the
cool.
genre can go into. So I think it's definitely still here. And every time I log on to Facebook, I usually have a comment or two to read from the Wizard Rock group. It didn't go the direction I thought it would. for various reasons, but it's still around. And I'm hoping that that kind of trajectory will keep up. I've also noticed some bands have switched from just Harry Potter to like other books and movies and stuff, kind of going the Filk mm-hmm. route. And I've been told that the Filk community also, by many of them are willing, are like pretty, they would take like Wizard Rockers, like, hey, you know, come over in our circles and sing your songs, because Wizard Rock and Filk are very similar, but there was often kind of been like a different culture, different subculture divide there. Not anything hostile, but, you know, just different sort of contexts. But I have heard that the Filk crowd would love to get some Wizard Rock folks involved in their convention shenanigans.
So what about you and Trina? What are you guys working on next? And particularly, what are you working on next as a scholar?
So I have very strange tastes in my scholarship. My primary interest right now, and my PhD research is focused on it, is Wikipedia, and in particular, fan editors of Wikipedia.
Ooh, so interesting.
What's mm-hmm. the information behavior of those folks? Like, why do they do it, what they do? How do they share that info? How do they find that info?
That's fascinating.
And it's been really interesting too. Like, it's another insider piece of scholarship, because I've been a Wikipedia editor since 2007. So it's similar in the sense that I'm looking into a community that I'm a part of, but I'm also asking other editors to try to see from the outside in. And I'm learning a lot of really interesting stuff. And it's always great getting to work with fans, because unlike a lot of other topics in the world, where if you ask someone like, oh, hey, can I interview you about this thing? Fans will almost never say no, because they're like, yes, I want to tell you everything about what I do.
It's the enthusiasm.
Exactly. And I love that, because they'll give you so much info. And I often say, like, people sometimes worry that they're giving me too much, but in this kind of research, that's not a thing. So just, if you want to talk for 20 minutes about this specific video game that you worked on, that is perfect. That's exactly what I need. So that's in the works. I'm also putting together two books. One is coming out from McFarland, that is a collection of edited essays about the cartoon Adventure Time.
Ooh,
that's
fun.
It's going to be some critical thoughts on that. I'm really excited for that one. And then another one is a production history of Adventure Time. I actually, kind of following this book here, I reached out to the producers and writers and started writing a history. And there was a big sort of drama there. It was initially going to be released through McFarlane, and then I had to release it on my own through the library I work with, the University of Kansas Libraries. But then the University Press of Mississippi told me that they'd be interested kind of in an updated version. So that is also coming out. So
that's awesome.
All over the place.
All good presses too.
And it's been fun. It's been interesting to talk to people and be like, hey, you know, I wrote this about Wizard Rock and I wrote this about Adventure Time, and can I ask you a question about, you know, some other random thing? And people are always like, what is it that you're studying again? And I have to say, technically Wikipedia, but that's neither here nor there.
Yeah, although I guess it's all fanish behavior. It's all like the things that people are doing just for the love of it, and that it's its own. I mean, it's interesting, because we're such a capitalist oriented culture, and the idea that people are doing these things without there being like a kind of big payoff potentially, right? You know, this is just people doing things that they love for other reasons. I think it is fascinating.
And that was kind of the tricky thing with the Adventure Time book, because let's just say Cartoon Network wasn't super enthused about me talking to people who were affiliated with the show. There were no threats or anything like that, but it was enough to be like, okay, maybe I shouldn't put it out on McFarlane. But then I talked to the other publisher, and they were basically like, what's Cartoon Network going to do? Sue the state of Mississippi for publishing a book, since it is a state run business, or and plus it's an academic work and all that fun stuff. So that capitalistic element is such a hindrance sometimes, because if I want to know about some movie or some book or some TV show, I can often email the people involved, but they'll be like, well, I can't talk about it because you know, HBO or whatever owns my soul. And so I'm like, okay, fine, fair enough. That's a bummer though. So I was really excited to have the Adventure Time folks, a huge chunk of the crew, like answer my questions.
And now for our special segment, Owl Post.
Look up, it's time for Owl Post.
Our letters today being delivered by our ever vigilant owl at Potterversity are all about our Secrets of Dumbledore episodes, the ones immediately previous to this one. And the first one is from Jan Votberg of Amsterdam. Emily, take it away.
That's right, Katie. Jan says, dear Katie and Emily and Beatrice, because she was our guest on that episode, one of the episodes, I enjoyed your 22nd broadcast very much. And every time it's a joy when one understands more details of the secrets of Dumbledore. I agree with that statement.
Mm-hmm.
In the broadcast, there is a reference to a scene in the third Despicable Me movie where the youngest girl mistakes a one-horned goat for a unicorn. More or less a parallel to this is a scene in the Prince Valiant strip, episodes 1703 and 1704 of September and October 1969. Queen Alita tells her youngest son, Galen, about the unicorn, and he gets out to bring her one, together with a virgin pure of heart. These are a one-horned goat and a young peasant girl. Wow, that's a deep dive. That's a deep reference.
1969. There is the one-horned goat slash unicorn representation. I like that. It's like the young peasant girl is the virgin pure of heart.
Yeah.
This is not an elitist version of either of those things, right?
That's true. That
something,
is true.
You know, common and accessible about them. I like
it. Yeah. Perfect for a comic strip, right?
Yeah. And, you know, and it just shows you that this, the, you know, the goat unicorn connection that Fantastic Beasts is drawing on with the Chilin, you know, that's something that actually there's an intertextual history of.
Right.
Right.
Right. Exactly.
So
on
really
point,
interesting.
Jan.
Yeah, very interesting observation, Jan. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah.
And keep listening. That's
yes.
great. We also have a comment from one of our sometime guests on Potterversity, Travis Prinzi, who sent us a letter to say, just got through the two episodes on Secrets of Dumbledore and love them. Thank you so much, Travis. So many thoughts. Who saved the wizarding world? Emily, do you remember that was your big question?
It's still ruminating in my mind.
That's a really good one. Yeah. And he says, yes, of course it was a combined effort, but none of those characters play any of those roles without Dumbledore's plan, especially with Fantastic Beasts 3 showing Dumbledore working out a master plan without the whole background question, is Dumbledore a bad guy, like we had in Harry Potter 7? It's a more sympathetic portrayal of Dumbledore as a mastermind. Yeah, I agree with that, right? You don't have all that dubiousness that you do in the Harry Potter series.
Right, so true.
And so Travis says, Dumbledore takes top spot for me. Completely agree with all the thoughts on Mads v. Johnny as Grindelwald. Way better, makes way more sense as someone Albus would have fallen in love with. I was also struck by the fact that so much was made of this international leadership position and didn't realize until after the movie it was Supreme Mugwump.
I'm so glad to hear him say that because I felt the same way.
Mm-hmm. They don't use the word mugwump.
No, because it's silly.
Yes, but like that's the word.
It is the word. And if they would have used it, I would have been right there with them.
Yes.
But I was spending the whole movie going, since when do we have an international leader of the wizarding kind?
Yeah.
But
right.
I was just
yes.
having
and
a,
I,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Didn't, well, I didn't connect the two up together. And if you just said
exactly.
mugwump.
Right. Just give me a mugwump. Give me a mugwump.
That is such a good word. Don't be afraid of the silliness.
Rolls off the tongue.
Yes. So, And so Travis says, I didn't realize until after the movie, it was Supreme Mugwump and Dumbledore had that role. I have to think she's saying something either about Wizarding World skepticism of the power of that role and deliberately diminishing its power, perhaps very shortly after the incidents of Fantastic Beasts 3. What an interesting observation. Or it's some kind of commentary on the breakdown of international cooperation over the years. I love that, Travis. Like, if we could get this to the script writers,
Yeah.
Right. Give them some things to think about, talk about politically.
I think they need this.
Yes, I do.
They do.
I do too. The ceremony, Travis says, is clearly exceedingly important to the wizarding world, and Grindelwald seems to have the power to simply change wizarding world policy by executive order and declare war on muggles immediately. Dumbledore, on the other hand, can hold the position while simultaneously being the chief warlock of the Wizangamot and running a school. That's a lot of multitasking for Dumbledore.
No small feat. Exactly.
Yeah. Right. Travis goes on. Even in the little history we have of Voldemort's first rise to power, there's not much talk of an international response. His main opposition came from the First Order of the Phoenix. Anyway, yeah. Excellent. Yeah. Anyway, excellent episodes. Beatrice's stuff on the Chillin and on Midsummer Night's Dream was gold. Totally agree. Thank you, Travis. Such interesting thoughts. And I do like the idea, right? That's a really important point. There's so little internationalism in the Harry Potter series.
Right.
What we get is through, you know, like the Triwizard Tournament,
right,
and some, you know, Quidditch matches, but there's not really a larger sense of wizarding world organization.
Right. Right. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. I do wonder about that as well. I mean, even the sort of awkwardness of some of the interactions, the cultural interactions surrounding the Triwizard Tournament almost mm-hmm. bespeaks the need for more of this international magical cooperation.
Yes.
Yeah.
No. And, you know, and I think that's maybe one of the things that's missing from the Harry Potter series that the Fantastic Beasts series is trying to fill in. You know, mm-hmm. it's so international. Mm-hmm. And in fact,
yeah.
it seemed like it was intended to be even more, you know, internationally oriented than what we've gotten thus far. But, you know, maybe it's supposed to fill that in, but I think we see a little weak spot in the world building with
yes.
that.
Yes. Yes. Every world has those, you know.
That's true.
Katie, our final piece of mail for this episode's mailbag is from our good friend, Lana Whited, who's been on the show several times with us. And she said, Emily, I listened to the most recent Potterversity podcast this afternoon and wanted to respond to a question you asked at the very end of the recording. I'm referring to what may have been your last comment when you asked whether the Fantastic Beasts series is about cute creatures and human goodness or the darkest aspects of human nature. When you said that, I yelled both at my phone. Lana, I'm so glad that someone else yells at podcasts, even when they're not in them or on them.
Right.
She went on to say, I'm reminded of the interview in which Rowling originally called Grindelwald the beast that was in the back of my mind for 10 years.
Mm,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. She also said that the Fantastic Beasts series is about the confrontation between the light and dark, her metaphor. So it's an and, not an or. She also said, I enjoyed hearing the outtakes and thought Emma did a great job of editing them together. Lana, we 100% agree with that
Absolutely.
Compliment and really any compliments that anyone wants to offer to our technical editor, Emma Nicholson.
Yes, absolutely. Emma. And I also agree about the and not or. And I think that's one of the things that makes that the whole world really interesting is that it has, you know, these light and light in the sense of good, but also, you know, kind of humorous.
Yes,
you know,
very
like touch kind of elements and also like really grisly and dark.
Yes.
And that I think you see that in the Harry Potter series.
Oh, absolutely.
Well.
Absolutely. And you know what? I wrote Lana back after her initial email and said, you know, I do agree that it is and it should be about both. And all of my favorite intellectual properties are about both. You know, they strike a balance. And that was one of the things that really first struck me about Harry Potter is how it balances the most serious questions we can ask with just moments of pure, you know, silliness and mm-hmm. words like mugwump,
right.
you know, to bring right. it full circle. But I guess my problem with the Fantastic Beasts series is the dark stuff gets a little too specifically dark. And that makes it difficult to discern the audience. You know, and I'm thinking about in the first movie, Graves's behavior toward Credence mm-hmm. and how it seemed to be, you know, borderline abusive
right.
or kind of grooming for abuse or whatever. Putting that next to, you know, a Niffler, you know, makes it really difficult for these films to discern their audience. Whereas in Harry Potter, the dark stuff was kept sort of archetypal, you know, and these questions of mortality, which really transcend the question of audience. You know, there's no audience that shouldn't be asking questions about what happens to us after we die and whether death is something to be feared. You know, that's an all ages question. But some of these other questions, fantastic piece. So I agree with Linda, I think in principle, but I think in the specifics and the particular ways that it's worked out in Fantastic Beasts, I still find it a little problematic, if that makes sense.
And I guess I wonder too, if the film nature of the Fantastic Beasts series, what we're always complaining about, that they're films and not books, if that makes it a little tougher to convey both and do that really well in a way that doesn't, you know, minimize the, you know, what Graves is doing with Credence.
Right.
You know, you don't want to minimize it.
Right.
And you also, you don't want to create a sense of this unrelenting evil so that people don't want to come back to the film. And I wonder if some of it's
to the world
film as opposed to book oriented.
Well, you're barking up my tree there, because I definitely agree that I would have loved to read these stories before they were films, in the same way that we got to with Harry Potter. And then we could kind of take a critical, you know, I mean, it's just, I'm one of those people who sees books as so much more full of possibility than films, you know, because that you can get into characters' minds much in a much more efficient and accurate way than you can in films.
And I think that you can see from just from the letters that we're all still thinking about the secrets of Dumbledore, it definitely raised a lot of really interesting questions and concerns, and that as we're thinking about, you know, what's next, we're trying to fill in some of those some of those little gaps that we might be getting, perhaps because it's in the film medium.
Yeah, I think this experience having these two conversations and then these continuing conversations about the film firmly puts me on the I hope there's more films side of the you know, in that camp, you know.
Me too. Yeah. Me too. Absolutely. So, thank you to everyone for your really thoughtful comments for our owl post. Our owl, you know, is, we have a more efficient owl than Errol, but he was stumbling a little bit after a pretty heavy mailbag there. So thanks and keep it up.
Yes.
He needs to work on his wing strength.
So. Yeah, indeed. Keep it coming.
Yeah, keep it coming. So Paul, also tell us what the eighth Horcrux is doing, and also tell listeners how they can access your music.
So the eighth Horcrux, we haven't recorded anything in a while now. The last thing we worked on was a parody of Old Town Road by Lil Nas X called the Sorting Hat, I believe. And it was for the Wizard Rock compilation in 2019. The pandemic sort of threw a curveball and disrupted a lot of our plans. So we haven't been doing a ton of stuff, but I'm still on the lookout for parodies. A lot of the stuff we really, really, really wanted to parody, we've already done. So now it's a matter of finding those like little gems here and there and polishing them and putting them out. But again, it's kind of anyone's guess what's happening on the horizon, just because everything is so up in the air. But if you're interested in hearing our music, you can just go to Bandcamp's probably the best place to find it. Our name is The Eighth Horcrux, eight like the letter and or eight like the number and then TH, The Eighth Horcrux. We should be the only band with that name, and we have all our
albums. You were easy to Google.
Yeah,
oh, I had perfect. No problem.
Same. Perfect. So yeah, we got all our albums, or at least all the albums were not ashamed of up there. And you can listen to them for free, or you can buy them if you'd like. I think they're reasonably priced, if I do say so myself, but you can always just listen to the tunes if you want to. That's really the best place to find us. I also am on Twitter, Paul Thomas 1992, but I mostly use that to talk about Adventure Time, which has sort of been the major love of my life these last few years. But I do definitely occasionally talk about Wizard Rock there. So feel free to follow me if you'd like. Yeah, my wife kind of stays off social media. She's a sixth grade teacher, so I kind of understand that.
Yeah, good for her.
But yeah, so those are the places that you can find us.
Awesome. And I really enjoyed listening to them. And I think, if you're a Harry Potter fan, that music, it tickles you, I just think it's delightful. So I had a
Yes, it
good time.
does.
And listeners, I think you will too. That brings us to the end of our show today. Thank you so much, Paul Thomas, for being here. And listeners, be sure to check out both his book, I Want to Rock, and the music of the Eighth Horcrux. Thanks, Paul.
Yeah, thank you so much.
This was so much fun talking to you about this. And as Emily said, we could probably ask you a zillion more questions, but I want to also say there's a lot more in the book that we didn't even talk about. So I hope people will pick it up because it really does give you a really in-depth view of the rock scene.
Yeah, I hope that people do pick it up or read it or get it through a library or however illegally download it, however they access it. I hope that they enjoy it and learn
Yeah.
something and about if they're in the community, learn something that they didn't kind of hadn't noticed, or if they're outside the community, recognize that wow, this is a really complex, diverse group of musicians.
Yeah, and you just have so many great stories, Paul, and I think that comes through in the book. The book was just very readable and a really good time. So I definitely encourage people to check it out. We are going to end today's episode with a quote from music-loving Hogwarts headmaster Albus Dumbledore, brought to tears. "Ah, music," he said, wiping his eyes, "a magic beyond all we do here." Keep the magical music going, my friends.
We hope you have enjoyed this episode of Potterversity. Send us your thoughts on the episode or propose ideas for future episodes by writing to potterversitypodcast@gmail.com. If you like the show, consider leaving a review on iTunes, and be sure to follow Potterversity on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Potterversity is brought to you by MuggleNet, the number one Wizarding World resource since 1999. Emma Nicholson is Technical Director, and the show is produced by Laurie Beckoff. Our theme music is performed by The Town, featuring Sean Elsburn, Scott Hacker, Travis Princey, Ashley Shepherd, and Emily Strand, and produced by Sean Elsburn. I'm your announcer, Dr. Sarah Brown.
Until next time. Class dismissed.